Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
I can never be replaced, though, no sooner than later. So that what I left is better than what I inherited, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow.
What's up?
There we go. I'm just going to take that to mean that it is time to hoop it up. We have so many basketball things to get into. I am excited and also in shambles, but mostly excited. We got the MVP results. We had playoff basketball. Damian Lillard got traded. The Warriors added Rudy Gay and Rodney Magruder. We got to see what that means. Jrue Holiday may also be rerouted somewhere. So that's more trade stuff to keep track of. Just a lot of things happening in both basketball leagues. Let's start on the NBA front, and then we'll slide into the W award talk / W playoff talk. There's a lot to get into there. The Blazers did the thing. They have traded Damian Lillard to a team in the Eastern Conference. They did not trade Damian Lillard to the team that many thought he would go to at the beginning of this ordeal. Damian Lillard is a Milwaukee Buck with Giannis and Chris Middleton and Brooke Lopez and insert Milwaukee Buck here. The Bucks getting Dame. The Blazers getting Jrue Holiday for now. DeAndre Ayton, Tumani Kamara, a 2029 first round pick from Milwaukee. First round pick swaps with Milwaukee in 2028 and 2030. The Phoenix Suns, who are the third team in this, get Yusuf Nurkic, Nasir Little, Keon Johnson, and Grayson Allen. Steve, where do you start?
What you mean? Why you ask me? You not know the history of this podcast? Go ahead and start with the Milwaukee Bucks and getting Damian Lillard.
Man, empty side, Dame and Giannis. Good freaking luck. But beyond like getting into some of the granular stuff, because I have thoughts on all of that stuff. What a swing for the Milwaukee Bucks. Fresh off of a disappointing playoff exit, Giannis was injured. Miami took their lunch money in the first round. You get all the rumblings and you get some talk from Giannis like, hey, I'd love to be here, but ultimately I want to win. I want to be the organization that has a chance of winning. If I feel like this team doesn't have, you know, isn't prepared to do that, then I may have to look elsewhere. And the Bucks are basically like, all right, bet. Here's Dame. Here is, in theory, like a perfect ball screen partner for you. Someone that can spread the floor for you. Someone that can unlock you as a screener. Just a legitimate superstar in this league. I think before even getting into what the fit will look like, that's such an important swing for Milwaukee. With Giannis being extension eligible and not knowing what's going on there. And some of the smoke around that situation. You land Dame, you got to feel better about your chances of securing Giannis long term again. So I start there. Beyond that, though, that's such a fun big three, if healthy. We know what kind of dynamic talent Damian Lillard is offensively. Someone that can spread the floor, that can pull up from anywhere. Steve, you have talked a ton about the improvement of Damian Lillard as a driver, or just the increasing intention for Damian Lillard as a driver and getting downhill. What that may mean for a Milwaukee offense that has sputtered sometimes over the past few postseasons. In the half court, having someone like Dame who can just generate attention and generate a good look by his lonesome, I think is important. And then once you add in the fact that he can play off of Chris Middleton, he can play off of Giannis, pick and pops with Brooke Lopez. There are so many things that Milwaukee can do with Damian Lillard, and there are so many things that should open up for the Bucks because of the presence of Damian Lillard. It's an exciting move. It's a big move for Milwaukee. I have thoughts on the other end, but that's where my mind immediately goes. What say you, good sir?
It is a big swing. And I know we're going to talk about everyone. If you're Portland, you were waiting to see if someone else was going to take a swing. If someone was going to feel the pressure to make the offer to get Dame. I don't think it was very easy for Milwaukee to trade Jrue Holiday. But I think in getting a player of the caliber of Damian Lillard, it makes all the sense in the world. You have one shot at that. And Dame and Giannis together is going to be so fun. We've seen both of them play with very good players. Neither of them have played with someone like this. And the benefits are going to be so key. It is an offense-defense trade-off. I think we can all admit that. But as you mentioned, offensively, there's so many different things you can do. Damian Lillard may not have to do as much on ball work, and it could open up some things for him off ball. Remember, some of the things that Portland ran for him last year, as far as post splits and staggers to open things up. Now imagine that's around a Chris Middleton post-up against a mismatch or a Giannis Antetokounmpo post-up. Also, remember, Coach Terry Stotts is in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And for anyone who remembers, the Blazers, way back in the day, had a ton of movement. And now you add in the fact that Giannis may not have to do as much on ball. And for me, my mind goes right to pick and roll. And I think for Damian Lillard, and I mean no disrespect, he's going to have some of the best pick and roll partners he's had. When you look at Giannis and pick and roll, and you look at how teams defend in Milwaukee, you got to make a lot of shots to get them to come up to the level. With Dame, it's different.
Yeah.
So you have Giannis as a screener. Forget empty side, forget small lineup. You have Giannis Antetokounmpo screening for Damian Lillard. You have to respect one of those things. Brook Lopez can roll, can pop, can flash in between the middle. That's someone he can play. Middleton, you can screen and attack switches that way. Giannis posting up and the type of spacing you can get. Inverted pick and roll with Dame screening for Giannis. The small lineups come playoff time with Giannis. It's going to be a lot of fun. So Milwaukee has opened up and raised their offensive ceiling in such a big way. Now let's talk about what teams have to think about. How do you spread your defensive capital, your defensive money against Dame, Giannis, and Chris Middleton? Because usually, whoever was going to guard one, who's going to guard the other? Who are you saying, okay, we're going to have to just give this one up? And that feels really big, especially when it comes playoff time. And that's where my head went.
I think that's going to be a lot of fun. Like, I think Dame just commands so much attention, to your point. And so you just think about general matchups, like Dame's probably going to get the best point of attack defender, best wing defender. That's automatically going to slot someone that is not as good or not as big or is big but not as agile on Chris Middleton. And your best big body is going to be on Giannis. That's going to open up some stuff for Brook. And like that was all already kind of the case, but it's to a greater degree now with Dame. Because of the attention he draws from the perimeter. Like Drew Holiday really improved as a shooter in Milwaukee. But he never commanded that kind of at the level attention, at least not consistently, where Dame just walks into the gym with it. And I think that's just going to have like a cascading effect on Milwaukee's offense.
Now, let me ask you a question before we keep going.
Okay.
I saw some concerns, just some vague. Hey, Dame needs the ball. Giannis needs the ball. Do people forget how Drew got some of his buckets?
They might have been lost in the other stuff with Drew.
It was a lot of self-creation, so I just wanted to point that out as well.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about the defense, though?
I would like to talk about the defense.
Because I have thoughts. I know you have thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I look at this move as a massive playoff spectrum type deal. They are going to miss Drew Holiday's defense. I don't think there's anyone who could say that they won't. The question will be, did they raise the offense enough to where it shifts? The defense could still be their undoing, but we can all be honest. There have been multiple years where defense has been Milwaukee's thing, and it hasn't always been the answer for them at that time of the year. I will say this move does put a lot of pressure on Chris Middleton and whoever the fifth is to produce defensively.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have to show up in a way. It can't be Jimmy Butler says, Chris Middleton, come here. It can't be that. There's going to have to be possibly some more rotations. There's going to have to be more locked in this. They're going to have to be better there. I will add this, though. Dame does get to play defense with Giannis and Brook behind him. And I think about Donovan Mitchell in particular. You can mm-hmm. add Darius Garland if you want. But you think about the reputation that Donovan Mitchell had when he was in Utah. And then the defensive year that he had in Cleveland. Ultimately, you could still poke at him, still attack him in the playoffs you want. But there was a level of you felt better about the effort he was giving. Having Jared Allen and Evan Mobley behind him sure made his job a lot easier to a degree. Mm-hmm. Hey, let me pressure the ball. Let me keep the ball in front. You know you have help behind you. And so for Dame, there's a world where he just has to be nails at the little things. Active, good help, good closeouts, keep it in front, show him recovery when you have to. I think we've seen an increase in that from him. So that's one thing I would probably float out there. Mm-hmm. But overall, they got to find out who that fifth person's going to be. And Middleton and Giannis are probably going to have to take a little bit more of the perimeter defensive role than in general. And that's not a shot at Giannis, by the way. Please don't take it that way. We all know what he can do defensively. But we do have some question marks about the screen navigation at times. And there may not be as much room for error for that. Plus, we don't even know what the scheme's going to be. That's the toughest part because it is a new coach, a new coaching staff. I would assume they would take a bulk of what Milwaukee had last year and look to implement it, but you never know. So we will see. We will see.
I think just kind of sticking with the theme of, because this was very much a playoff move for Milwaukee. Like, duh, you want to add a talent like Dame, but you're adding a talent like Dame so you can solve some of these questions that you had in the playoffs. And I think he very firmly, if healthy, that's the obvious caveat for all of these discussions. But if healthy, I think he absolutely solves one. Like, we have a guy that will draw two to the ball. We have a guy that can space for Giannis, someone that can play off of Giannis, someone that can take the burden off of Giannis, and vice versa. Defensively, there is the obvious downgrade and defensive aptitude from Jrue Holiday to Damian Lillard. I think that is fair to say. That's not disrespectful to either party. That just is what it is. Beyond that, though, the fact that, you know, this trade's made, we're recording on September 28th, trade made September 27th. We're post a lot of the free agency stuff or whatever. The fact that Dame was the sole addition isn't Dame plus insert random rotation please here. One of the questions I had about Milwaukee entering the offseason, regardless of any of this talk, was, hey, what's going to happen with this wing room in the playoffs? Do they have size? Because that's kind of what they've run into with Boston in particular, where Boston has Jason Tatum, they have Jaylen Brown, they have good defenders. Again, Drew's tremendous in particular. But at the end of the day, Drew's 6'3". And he may be good enough to defend the Jason Tatum. He's not big enough to defend the Jason Tatum. He may be good enough to defend the Jaylen Brown. He's not big enough to defend the Jaylen Brown. And so they haven't answered what is the option for the big wings. What is the answer for the Jimmy Butler? What is the answer for the Jason Tatum or the Jaylen Brown? Or insert big wing here. To your point, Steve, I think the gamble is very obviously our offense will be good enough, and we feel like our offense was a bigger problem than the specific wing defense issue, that it may not matter. But it is fair to note, they have not solved that part of the equation. And so I wonder what this means for Marshawn Beauchamp. This is going to be a big year for him. Like, I floated the Andre Jackson thing on the timeline yesterday. I don't know how much, it's a new coach, I don't know how much leeway Adrian Griffin plans to give a rookie in Andre Jackson, but he is someone that can defend and someone that is smart spatially, offensively. The jumper is the biggest question mark, but willing screener, good cutter, good ball mover, etc. I think there's a pathway to him earning some more playing time than someone would anticipate heading into this offseason anyway. But that remains a question mark with this trade. And in getting rid of Drew, but also getting rid of, you know, Grayson Allen, who isn't a world beater, especially defensively. He was also someone that got picked on. But in terms of like the salary slot, you also remove some options to address that via trade, too. And so I think this is a pretty interesting internal bet for them as well.
Let me float something out to you.
Okay.
Just an idea I have bouncing off what you said. We know how they feel about Pat. Mm-hmm. Connaughton. Some may feel differently about Jay Crowder, but he is still there and can provide some of those things. What if the bid is, hey, Giannis, you may not have to do as much offensively. You could take some of these matchups, man. Does that shift things?
I think it absolutely can, because we know how good Giannis is dialed in. It points back to something that you've mentioned, something that I've talked about. The screen navigation for Giannis. And I wonder, like, what does that look like for him? Does he just get better at it? I don't think that's something that he's just deadlocked. This is it. This is the ceiling. He can't do it. Does he get better at screen navigation? One. Two, scheme wise, if he does get the Jason Tatum matchup and Boston immediately says, all right, cool, we're going to run double drag with Jason Tatum. Is it just auto switch and then you're still in the same boat? or what are the kind of, what are the kind of safeguards, I guess, scheme wise, to make that work in light of where Giannis is as a screen navigator? Because I think if it's just one-on-one in space, someone calls a clear out on Giannis, like, I think he can just flat out defend Jimmy Butler. He can flat out defend Jason Tatum. Insert wing here. I think that's cool. It's Giannis off this down screen, Giannis off this stagger, Giannis defending this pick and roll where it gets dicey for him. So he can be the answer. I just want to see what that looks like and how willing he is to do that. And I said, I guess more so regular season willingness. I was like, I think in the playoffs, he, for better or for worse, he will do what's asked of him defensively. We've had plenty of conversations about that kind of thing. I guess regular season, I want to see.
My mind was more towards the playoffs.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And like again, like I think that can be an answer. I would just want to see it. Because if he gets better at screen navigation, yeah, like that, Dame, you do all this pick and roll stuff. Take some of the offensive burden off of me. I'm going to get easier looks. Like, the screening is going to be easier for Giannis this year. Is the other part. Like, I think he's a pretty solid one to begin with. But, like, he doesn't have to get full contact all the time. I would imagine defenders are just coming up to the level. He may get more slips than he's ever gotten before. And so you get the same efficiency bump as Giannis as screener without him taking the physical toll. And now he's getting easier looks at the basket, or he's getting easier kick out passes on the short roll. And that takes some of the physical strain, which gives him more juice in theory to fight over the screen and stay attached versus I got dinged, I'm pointing, I'm switching out, and then I'm peeling over for help or whatever, which has kind of been the case earlier in his career. So I think that could absolutely be it. Briefly off of Milwaukee, I want to move to Phoenix for a moment. Yusuf Nurkic and Nasir Little, Grayson Allen, they send out DeAndre Ayton in this deal. I don't want to speak for you. I feel like DeAndre Ayton is a better player than Yusuf Nurkic. And I think there's a bit of a drop off there. Do you think the differences in the games of Yusuf Nurkic and DeAndre Ayton, plus the wings that they also added, makes this a worthwhile bet for Phoenix?
What you mean? You're supposed to say Phoenix got fleeced. Oh. Isn't that the verse you're supposed to go with?
That would appear to be the bit.
My first thought when that happened was, okay, so that Nurk Ayton talk was really real. I'm glad I paid attention. Number two, I went to, is there a money thing behind this? And then I think I read the breakdown. And it was like, no, they actually got, like, they took on more money. And I was like, okay. Salary's smaller, but that wasn't the bit either. If you look at it from a bigger picture, I don't think there's anyone I could sit and argue with. If you want to tell me DeAndre Ayton is better than Yusuf Nurkic from a pure talent perspective or salary or draft pick, I get it. It looks away when you go from Ayton to Nurkic. I totally understand that. For me, we have to kind of just unravel it and look at it. Last few years, DeAndre Ayton, not counting last year, DeAndre Ayton has been the number what option for the Suns?
Probably four, sometimes three.
Four, sometimes three. DeAndre Ayton, if you had to give a number of the joy and happiness he's had being in Phoenix the last 2 years, what number would you put it?
Four, sometimes three.
Did we not get Jock Landale should play more minutes during that playoff series, or am I misremembering?
No, we absolutely got that.
Okay. So, if the narrative around Phoenix is these opinions on Ayton, who's the fifth guy for their lineup? What's their bench going to look like? What's their depth? Guess who's the only piece you have to try and address that with?
DeAndre Ayton.
It's DeAndre Ayton. And real quick, before we get to Nurk, I think people are having an issue with the word depth. So I'm going to propose something else, Nikias.
Okay.
They have more options. They have more pieces. They have more variety to try and find that fifth player. They have more competition. They have more ways to find who are going to be the top nine guys who ride with us as the season builds on. Mm-hmm. They have an opportunity to find the archetype that really works with their top guys. Because they have size, they have some length, they have some shooting. They have different things. I think it's going to help once they start staggering lineups and subbing their guys in and out. Got to remember, there's always going to be a really good player on the court as long as everyone's still healthy. So you just need guys to fit specific boxes. And that's where I ask you this question. How good do you need your big to be on this team, Nikias?
To steal one of your phrases, they just need to, they can't be in the liability zone.
And that's where I go with this one. I think there's probably a higher likelihood that you could get Nurk to buy into that specific role and execute it than DeAndre Ayton. And that's no disrespect. That's no attitude questions. I just think the buildup of Ayton's career in Phoenix with the changes Phoenix has made, it's going to be difficult. Mm-hmm. And he's looking at a scenario where he, again, is what option on this team?
Four, probably five.
So, I think you get Nurk to screen, rebound, finish, defend. He can execute some dribble handoffs. I think he took a career high 2.3 threes a game. Mm-hmm. There's different avenues there to get Nurk to do his job. And if the bonus is we added more pieces to our bench, I think it's a win. Now, I'm going to ask another question.
Okay.
Because it's been a hot take simmering in the back of my brain. I'm higher on Nurk on defense than most. I do believe he is a guy you can get to a do-your-job level defensively, and I do believe that he is with a coach who can find a way to get that done. Because if you put a percentage on the number of bigs who have at least passed class defensively with Frank Vogel, it's pretty high. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I will say very clearly, and I apologize to anyone this offends, no more defensive anchor talk. We don't have to do that. He's fine, but we don't have to do that. No disrespect. I'm going to ask you this question. How big is the gap between DeAndre Ayton and Yusuf Nurkic in pick and roll defense?
So, like, I'm not trying to do, like, the thing or be annoying about it. But, like, my honest answer is it depends on how engaged Ayton is. If you are telling me I am getting 2021 playoff level effort DeAndre Ayton, I think it's a pretty sizable gap. Because I don't think there's a ton of scheme versatility with Nurk, mobility questions, et cetera, et cetera.
Give me the butt.
But if it is the Ayton that we got for large portions of last season, and in some of the lead up to the 21 playoffs in particular, I don't think there's a big difference. And in fact, a lot of, like, we don't have a ton of great defensive numbers, but you look at, like, shots defended at the rim, field goal percentage, whatever, whatever. Like, Nurk low-key graded out better than Ayton in some of those last year.
Okay. Okay. That's closer to my point. Are the question marks similar enough to where you feel like if we take rid of whatever the thing is that we don't know about that's going on as far as mindset, attitude, buy-in, all that good stuff, are we answering the same on-court questions? Because when you look at the drop, right, mm-hmm. they both can be very deep. They both can give up too much space. They both can get beat in between, right? Mm-hmm. This is an issue for both of them. Ayton does have a higher ceiling, so I will say that. You could probably feel better about the switch, but you could probably late switch both of them, no?
Yeah, and to your point, like, Ayton has more upside in that part, but we are here because Ayton doesn't consistently hit that upside. That's why we're even having this conversation. If he did, Phoenix wouldn't want to trade him.
So that's where kind of my mind is going, where I understand what people are saying, and maybe the volume is a little bit higher on some of these songs, but they're making similar music. Mm-hmm. And Phoenix still has to answer the same questions regardless. Now, one thing I'll flip and ask you, how much does the size of the Phoenix Suns help him potentially?
That was going to be something that I brought up. Like, this is also going to be some, you know, this is the most length Nurk has had around him maybe ever, or like at least the early Blazer days for him. Again, like, is Bradley Beal a world beater at the point of attack? Like, no, he's not. I expect more buy-in defensively from him than we've seen in years past. And so that should be better. But like Devin Booker has turned himself into a credible defender. Kevin Durant just length everywhere. And if you are sliding in Josh Okogie to take on more point of attack stuff, like that helps. If it is going to be Kata Bates' job, 6'8", 6'9", rangy, that's more length around Nurk. Like his job should be easier. But like I think the pathway is there for Nurk to just buy into a degree that we haven't seen consistently with Aiden defensively. And to your point, if he gets to the do your job level with all this length, and then you zoom out and think about Phoenix and it's like, this should just be a top three offense conservatively. And so they only need to be like 14, 15 in defensive rating. Yeah, like I absolutely get the gamble for Phoenix.
And now I'll add another one, Nikias. How much does having Kevin Durant on the weak side at times help him with some of these coverages that we may not feel are the best for Nurk?
Mm-hmm. To my point, like I didn't love Nurk at the level. I thought that was better than him in a drop because I've just, you know, I have my thoughts with Nurk in a drop. But now you can more credibly put Nurk at the level knowing that Kevin Durant's behind you. And some of these other free agent signs that they had, like that's again, this more weak side stuff and more weak side options that they have at their disposal coming off the bench. It should function better.
Now, I wanted to say that. Now, if you can't find a scheme for him and it just doesn't work, we're going to have a different conversation. Totally aware of that. But I wanted to make sure I pointed that out because I didn't want things to get so lopsided here with that. Here's my thing with Nurk, and this is my portion of the program as far as, wait a minute. He's going to have to finish. If there's two things we're talking about, it's finishing and defense. And the number one thing for me is the finishing. He's going to have to finish in a better way than he has in a while. And honestly, honest to God, if he finished more, we are not having this conversation right now.
Nope.
He's going to have to make those decisions on the short roll, especially on a team with KD, with Booker, with Beal, who are inevitably going to get various versions of two on the ball, whether it's off a down screen, whether it's off a handoff, pick and roll. So he's going to have to be able to catch, make decisions on the roll, whether it's a kick, whether it's a finish. It can't be the offensive fouls that we've seen him draw sometimes. So if that portion isn't nails, the defense, it doesn't matter as much to me. Because that part is going to be what it is. If he can't do the offensive part, I have concerns. That sounds wild because I love defense. Defense is very important, but that's where my mind goes. What say you, sir?
No, I'm right there with you because I think in theory, and we talked a little bit about this before recording, like you've made a comment before, like with Phoenix and their roster construction, how they want to build this out with all the star talent that they have, that they should take a page out of the Liberty's book. Let's establish the movement and ball movement, player movement. Let's establish that first and then lean on the talent when we have to. And I think if you were going for that kind of system, having Yusuf Nurkic as a hub, someone that can flow into delay actions, is a really rugged screener, a good passer for cutters, can make some short roll decisions on the move. I think he fits. And if that ceiling is hit, you can't do much with Bradley Beal. You can't do much with Devin Booker. You can't do much with Kevin Durant. And now if you try to trap any of those, Nurk can make good decisions. And if the fifth is a player that is knocking down shots, whether that's just overall or from the corners, or is a smart cutter in confined space and fine pockets, you just don't have a real avenue to defend his offense. And Nurk, also a really good offensive rebounder. But I'm with you, though. He has to be able to finish. Because if it's still the same, he's missing bunnies or the offensive fouls, to your point, I can kind of I can change how I send my help in a playoff setting. Or at least in theory, you can kind of change how aggressive you want your help or your rotation to be if we're trapping KD or trapping Beal or trapping Booker, knowing, we don't trust Nurk to finish the play, whether that's at the rim or he's not going to avoid our weak side help filling in. We're going to be able to get him for one or two. If he can't solve that, it makes it easier to defend those stars. And it's going to be not necessarily a repeat, but it's going to be very similar to what Denver did in the second round, to where they got to a level of comfort of sending two to the ball, helping off of insert player here or shading help to this position here, because we know we don't trust the fourth or the fifth to consistently beat it. And so I think it's going to be a big year for Nurk on that front.
Now, here's the one thing that I think also is getting underrated. If there's nothing else, Nurkic is going to rebound that basketball. He's going to rebound that ball, and I think that's important. Mm-hmm. When you combine the, you can kind of get there, you add some depth, it can make it work. I'm not as down on it as some people are. Now, I have to ask you, how did you feel about the other pieces that Phoenix acquired? Because this feels directly in your wheelhouse.
Oh, goodness. Very obvious caveat. These players have to stay healthy. And that is specifically true for Nasir Little, who probably just was not like a top 10 pick in his draft class because of health concern. But if you can pencil in 62 games of Nasir Little, I love the blend of defense, on-ball defense, and general versatility from him. And if you're looking for a fifth option, the quote-unquote fifth to play along the stars, or I guess the stars plus Nurk, if you're looking for a fifth, like, he could very well slide into that. He is someone that can defend up or down the positional scale. He is someone that can knock down enough shots. He has enough ball skills to attack closeouts and gets downhill. For all the talk about, you know, depending on which three team or four team construction you were hearing about before the deal actually got made, Suns linked to Caleb Martin. Suns briefly linked to OG Anunoby. Nasir Little isn't either of those two guys, but like, he's within that same kind of prototype on this team. And I think he is good enough, also young enough, and locked into a new contract signed not too long ago, to where he's someone that can also grow with this group, in addition to filling a role that they may need. So, like, I like the Nasir Little flyer. Grayson Allen, if you want toughness slash irritation, but also you just want shooting, and someone that very quietly got better at attacking closeouts last year, he's going to help. He is a quality regular season rotation piece. He is someone that has proven to be picked on in a playoff setting defensively. He tries. There's just a lack of size, lack of wingspan. There's only so much he can do when teams try to post him up. I think he will be insulated in a way similar to the Milwaukee situation. Phoenix isn't as big or as ranked. They aren't as big as Milwaukee with that front line was with Brook and Giannis. But you do still have a good deal of length behind Grayson if you are playing him important minutes in a playoff setting. But at bare minimum, he gives you regular season value. He gives you someone that can shoot and also is very willing to shoot, because very quietly, Phoenix was not a team that took a lot of threes last year. And post Kevin Durant trade, they certainly were in a team that took a lot of threes. And then once you got into the playoffs, a lot of their threes were very much filtered to the guys that teams wanted to take those shots. I'll put it that way. And so if Grayson Allen is in that slot, you don't feel as good helping off of him. You may still have to if the options are Bradley Beal, Kevin Durant, Devin Booker, or Grayson Allen. Yeah. But Grayson Allen can also shoot the leather off the ball. So, like, I like the flyers for Phoenix. And if the series stays healthy, I think their Suns fans are really going to have fun with him.
Yeah, health is always a thing. But I think the fact that they have him and he's still not, he's not like he's old, you know? It's someone you will have in your program for a little bit. I just like the fact that they have more pieces. They can mix and match. They could, in theory, depending on what they need, go with a different look. You know, if they want defense, we got Josh, you know. You still have Yuta, you have Damian Lee, you have Eric Gordon, you have Grayson Allen, you have Nasir Little. You have bits and pieces that could go on. Those guys could probably play together. And so these are folks that can fit these roles, check these boxes off, help your team in that way. And as long as the core is able to stay on the court, I think it makes a lot more sense than people are giving it credit for. Is it a total game shifter? Did they answer every question? Probably not. But they at least give themselves more room to try and figure this out, which I think is important. We've seen teams, okay, these are our guys. Oh, no. I don't know. I can't get past that part.
No, I got you. I'm really intrigued with Nasir. Also, just a quick note on that. He turns 24 in February.
Yeah, I'll
do he it. Is, he is very young entering his second contract. So, like, that should be fun. How do you feel about the Ayton fit in Portland? Because he's the, of all the players that are getting in, they're getting Drew, but Drew's going to end up getting rerouted somewhere else. Ayton is kind of the piece that Portland got out of this. How do you think slots in with these young guards?
What you mean? Slots in well. It's a great return. We had all this conversation and Portland just got an 18 point per game, 10 rebound player. That's not bad. Like, I know the conversation is rough around DeAndre Ayton and there are some things he has to work on and there are potential playoff limitations, but we have to remember he's very talented.
Mm-hmm.
I do find it ironic that the Blazers ended up trading for this type of big while sending Dame out, but that is what it is. DeAndre Ayton, still young. He can grow with this team. He can help you craft your vision moving forward. You potentially have cornerstones you could build around. If he's not the answer, he'll probably produce in a way you can still pivot in the future. I think we're forgetting new role, new energy, new space. He's going to have a runway. And I think one of the things we got to realize is how important context and fit and opportunity are. We said DeAndre Ayton was option number what in Phoenix? We settled on 4, right?
Mm-hmm.
In Portland, he's option number what?
I mean, lowest the keys, he's probably still going to be 4.
How's he 4?
I mean, if you are anticipating, like, Scoot's going to start, Anfernee Simons is actually going to take a lot of stuff, and then you have Jeremy Grant still there.
There's more of a chance for him to be involved, though, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's my point. Probably more of an idea for the pick and roll to pop with Scoot, right?
Yeah.
Probably more actions that he can be a part of, right?
Indeed.
So I think there's value in that. And with that value, and the other part is, who's taking his minutes?
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you piece those two things together, we may wind up with a scenario where DeAndre Ayton grows in the areas that we currently see as struggles because the opportunity is going to be there. Mm-hmm. He may develop because some of that stuff is off the table. And I think, here, I'll put it to you this way, man. Since you want to call him the fourth option in Portland.
No.
Nikias Duncan, you're one of the elite analysts featured in 2K on Instagram every day, all this good stuff. You're one of the best. Let's say we take your talent and I tell you, hey, bud, 350 words every week. That's all you get. How you feeling?
Not great. Not happy to be, not excited to be here. Happy to be here.
No,
bounce and bracing, you know?
No, we know what you can do, Nikias, but we just need you to do all that in 350 words. Just deliver us all of that in 350 words. You got that? Cool? We're good?
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a great time.
Now compare that with, hey, Nikias, this is what we want you to talk about. Have a blast. How do you feel?
A lot better.
We got to think about that with DeAndre Ayton in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
Even if he had the opportunity to do the same things, it will feel a different way.
Mm-hmm.
That's my thoughts. What do you think about DeAndre Ayton in Portland?
I think my general thought is, like, I am glad that he is with, I'm just glad that he's with a younger group, period. Because I think he is someone that has wanted more leeway than he's gotten because Devin Booker got so good. And the Ricky Rubio trade worked out the way it did. And then that led into the Chris Paul trade, which led to finals appearance, which led into, hey, we got our superstar in Devin Booker. It is time to win now. And sorry, DeAndre, we don't have the room to let you explore with your mid-post game. Or your face-up game. We kind of need you to help open these other guys up. You have Chris Paul. We need you to open things up for that mid-range game, et cetera, et cetera. We got Devin Booker. This is what we need from you.
And so also, to bounce off your point before you continue, you can't miss on these other things, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, you can't be bad at this stuff. Like, you gotta go from, like, 6 to 10 all the time. But continue.
Correct. Because if you do miss on those, Bismack Biyombo ain't as talented as you, but he will screen and he will dive and he will also defend. Last year, Jock Landale, he will screen, he will dive or pop a little bit, make some passes. He will try to defend within scheme. Do your job or else. And so with this Portland group, he's not going to have that same pressure. Portland's not trying to win right now. So like that already takes a little bit of the edge off. But to your point, like he doesn't have super vets that have proven to be trustworthy in the case of Biombo. And then like Jock Landale kind of, he just came out of nowhere for Phoenix and was good. But he doesn't have that over his shoulder either. I am interested to see like just what the general relationship between him and Chauncey Billups is going to be like. Like, I just don't have intel or anything on that. So like, I just want to see what that's going to look like. Once we get some media day quotes, we get into the regular season. I just want to like read Portland people and stuff and see what that looks like. So I'll keep an eye on that.
Somebody's just going to ask him about his time in Detroit. And he's going to talk about, I know how to craft digs. Fast forward to that, bud.
Okay. Well, there we go. You heard it here first, folks. But no, like I think it's just going to be less pressure on him with a younger core. I think there's going to be more room for him to relate off the floor. I'm here to see like random Twitch stream with like him and Scoot playing Call of Duty or something like that. Like that should be fun. Like that. Those are the kind of things that may not super like quote unquote matter in the basketball sense, but they matter. Like ultimately you're not going to get buy-in from a player that's not happy. And if he's not happy with his role and he's also like the young dude while the core is this. Yeah, it's kind of easy to kind of insulate and get in your own bubble and just I don't do my job and get out of here. And so like I would like to see how him and Scoot interact, how him and Anthony Simons interact. Just the general young nature of the roster. Like, what does that look like? And from a basketball perspective, to your point, he is very talented. He is someone throughout his career who has proven he can screen well and dive hard. He is someone that can face up and knock down jumpers. He is someone that can face up and drive to the basket. He is someone that has displayed scheme versatility defensively. He is someone that has shown he can be a monster on both sides of the ball in terms of rebounding. I would like to see him put all that together. Because if he does, Portland has absolutely hit on this. And so I'm glad that he's in this kind of situation to where I think he has more room to hit his ceiling in Portland.
I personally think the more room is more important than he thinks he's very good at basketball. But, you know, time will tell on that. The other part that's huge here, Jrue Holiday. And not Jrue Holiday, Portland Trailblazer. Jrue Holiday, second trade.
Yeah.
And I'm stuck on Portland being able to get two trades for one by getting Jrue. And here's the thing, Nikias. Here's the thing about the Jrue Holiday market. It's not just Jrue's talent. Unbelievable defensive player. I get that some people are calling him Eric Bledsoe, but hey, Milwaukee won, right?
Yeah.
Okay. They won a whole ring or just.
I think sources say they did win a full ring.
Got it. But with Dame going to Milwaukee, guess what we have on our hands, Nikias? A whole new sense of urgency from war teams. I know you don't watch reality TV, but it reminds me like on The Bachelor when they just changed the rules and now everyone's in chaos for like one episode.
Here come the X's, huh?
It's like, okay, all right. So now we have a whole new market, more urgency, and you're going to get more people involved. It's a bonus. So for me, I just overall, if you're Portland, yes, you lose Dame. And that's a whole different conversation for a whole different day that I can't even process right now. You get Scoot, you get DeAndre Ayton, whatever you get back for Jrue Holiday, that feels a whole lot better than 34 games of Otis Thorpe.
You are never going to let that one go, huh?
Or Theo Ratliff and Sharif Abdul-Rahim.
Okay, so I'm going to let
unhealed trauma. It's fine.
Okay, I'm going to let you sit with that one, dear friend. My apologies. On the Jrue front, between Barry Jackson, Miami-based reporter. Don't do this. Between Barry Jackson, between Brian Windhorst, Miami, both of the LA teams, Philadelphia, Boston, Chicago have all been listed as teams expected to showcase interest in Jrue Holiday. What would you say is Drew's best fit?
Before we get to best fit, I kind of want to have some more fun because we've kind of been analyzing right here.
Mm-hmm.
Funnier thing, Miami or Philadelphia?
Oh, Lord. Funnier is probably Philly. The Miami thing is just, that could just be a separate podcast for me. On all that fallout and all that good stuff.
Y'all been talking a lot. I don't get it. We can bookmark that at the end of this. Once we talk about some Drew destinations. But I don't understand what y'all doing, man.
Oh, Lord. It's just the culmination of multiple years of stars being linked to the Heat and not getting them for various different reasons. And that goes into team building and asset talk and all kinds of stuff. It's just a whole thing with Miami. So funnier answer, I think funnier is Philly for me.
Okay.
And maybe that's just because I'm just too close to it. But yeah. But Miami being linked to Drew is interesting, if for no other reason than because they were linked to Dame and those talks apparently got contentious. And now it's like, well, hey, you couldn't get this all-star guard. How about this one? Like, how do we expect those negotiations to go? Both of the LA teams being linked are interesting. Like, I can very clearly see it with the Clippers. And like, from a basketball sense, I can see it from the Lakers. But it's more so like, what do the Lakers have to offer to get Drew in the building? It's kind of weird. Like, obviously they have, it's more reasonable for them to get Drew than it would have been for like Dame. But my mind just kind of goes to, okay, what is the package? Like, what would the Blazers, I would imagine 3-team deal, but like D'Angelo Russell, I guess, as like the piece. And then like, I don't know, because I'm also trying to remember, was that just extension versus re-signing? What does that mean for like the December 15th date, or is he available to be traded now? Yada, yada. So I don't know. Like the Lakers, I don't really get how they get there, but I understand why they would want him. Boston is the one that I can't really wrap my head around. That's another, I get why they would want him, but because of Drew's salary and what they would have to give up, like, I think Boston would be willing to, you know, use Malcolm Brogdon as the biggest piece in that package. But also, Malcolm Brogdon would have been traded a month and a half ago if waves arms wildly. So I don't know what that looks like. And then it's Malcolm Brogdon and what? If it's Brogdon and Horford, I don't know if I like that. If it's Brogdon and Rob Williams, I don't know if I like that. Especially since it's not just trading for Drew and whatever like roster shifts you have to do there if you're including one of those bigs. It's trading for Drew in light of getting rid of one of those bigs in the deal, and then also having to figure out, what does the next Drew deal look like? And that's where I'm just like, I don't know if Boston makes a ton of sense in the Drew Holiday sweepstakes. Am I off on that? Or how did you feel about Drew in Boston? Because like, if you lose Marcus Smart in a deal and then you get Drew Holiday back, like, I think you feel good about it. But I don't know how they get there.
I felt more like I would understand, but also,
yeah,
like, I felt like it's one of those things that you could do if you wanted to. Oh, the Blazers dropped the Dame tribute vid.
All
right, no more scrolling.
After Dame dropped the song. Okay, so, and then Chicago also linked to Dame. I mean, linked to Drew. I guess they were also linked to Dame, but like, linked to Drew. I would laugh maniacally at like Alex Caruso and Drew Holiday on the same team, but like, also, we're starting division preview soon. And by soon, I mean like next week. We'll talk about Chicago relatively soon. I just have thoughts on what's going on there.
What do you mean? What do you mean you have thoughts? You've had thoughts. This is not new. I am a person who listens to what you say and remembers what you said. This is not new.
It's not, but it's just like, dang, dog. What?
Chicago literally has to win 8 out of 10 games for your thoughts to shift a tiny bit.
Look, man, I have ceiling questions with Chicago. Like, what would a Drew deal look like? Because that's them trying to, I would imagine they want to keep their quote unquote big three together if they're going to do it. What is that? Kobe Caruso? Another piece? It's going to be hard to get there salary wise. To the point where it kind of has to be one of their big three. And it's like, I don't think Chicago would do a deal based around Zach LaVine. And also, Zach LaVine was linked to Portland during all this stuff, and apparently Portland wasn't super interested in Zach to begin with. Like, it didn't appear to be like a super frothy market for him to begin with. I don't, what does DeMar do for Portland? That would just be another reroute situation, I would imagine. And he just brought back Vooch. So I don't really see that either. Like, I kind of eye Miami and the Clippers would kind of be where I'm at. I guess the Miami, the Clippers, and Philly in some order would probably be my top three among those teams listed. Do you have an ideal landing spot for Drew?
Sixers or the Clippers for me.
Okay. I like Drew next to Maxey. That'd be cool. Also, they still just have to figure out the Wave's arms wildly. Last report I saw, I wish I could remember who the exact reporter was, but I don't think James Harden is going to be there at media day, which would make sense. So we will see what happens out of Philadelphia. Other NBA news, Rodney Magruder, Rudy Gay to the Warriors, I guess, for camp deals. We'll see if either one of those guys make the official roster, so that's cool. Any closing NBA thoughts before we shift to the W?
No.
All right. Well, MVP was announced. First reported by the committee, so shout out to the homies. Breanna Stewart, winning MVP with 446 total points, edging out Alyssa Thomas by 7 points. And edging out Asia Wilson, who finished third by 13 points. That was the closest three-player race in WNBA history, which kind of spoke to how good all three of those players were and how splitting hairs between those three proved to be pretty darn difficult. Breanna Stewart basically won by the second-place votes. Alyssa Thomas had 23 first-place votes. Stewie had 20. But Stewie had 23 second-place votes, while Alyssa Thomas had 12. It felt very much like Alyssa Thomas was first or third for people. And that is ultimately what gave Breanna Stewart the edge in the actual race. But that was fun. An incredible season from Breanna Stewart. Career high in scoring, career high in assists, elite efficiency. Not quite career levels, but still elite efficiency. We've talked ad nauseum about how important she's been to New York's defense, which was an elite defense this season after, let's say, not being elite last year. It's hard for me to get upset about the actual results. Like, we gave our winners on our award episodes. Like, you landed on Stewie as your MVP. I had Asia as my MVP. Alyssa Thomas obviously would have been a very worthy MVP winner. But, like, I'm not super upset about how it broke out. I think Stewie had a strong case and she won. Honestly, my question just becomes, how does Asia Wilson get a fourth place vote? That's kind of the only, that's probably the biggest takeaway I have from the MVP voting. Cause that just struck me as odd. I'm not going to rant too much about it. I'll turn the floor over to you for any MVP thoughts you may have. That's what raised my brow.
Why did it raise your brow?
Brother, I do not understand how you watch the Las Vegas Aces and land on Asia Wilson is the second most important player on the team. That is hard. That is a hard thing for me to digest.
Chelsea Gray slander?
It's not Chelsea Gray slander. It's more Asia Wilson does so much on both ends of the floor for this team. And it is hard for me to get to Chelsea, as important as the playmaking role is for this Aces team. It's hard for me to get to, she is more important than Asia. She absolutely accentuates what Asia does. And I do think, like, quietly, like, Chelsea being able to switch the way that she does defensively does help with the lineup, does help with the defensive versatility. It doesn't set the table for the defensive versatility like Asia does. The playmaking doesn't set the table for, I guess in a literal sense, like what Asia means for, it's hard for me to get to that. That's more about how high I am on Asia than like Chelsea slander.
Question for you, bud.
Okay.
What was the stat you told me? The Aces have the what offense in WNBA history?
Greatest offense in WNBA history.
What if someone saw that and saw the assists and the playmaking and opening things up for everyone and setting the table and valued that role in creating the best offense in WNBA history while also still scoring, getting buckets, you know?
Ah, but then also Asia won Defensive Player of the Year. So like that.
I'd said offense.
I know. I'm just saying. But like that would also just be the rebuttal. Like even if you go there with that case, it's just like.
What do you mean? Why is defense the rebuttal?
because that other end also matters in terms of determining value.
You're not that person, though. Everyone's different.
That's true. That is true. You know, it's fine. That's fair. I just very strongly disagree with that notion. I guess
here's the thing I would encourage folks to do. Mm-hmm. You don't have to agree with everything, but can you understand where someone's coming from?
Can I be respectfully messy very quickly?
Go ahead, bud.
I would have higher odds of understanding where someone else is coming from if they would explain what their reasoning was, and if we had a way to know what the reasoning was, if we had a way to know who voted for who.
What do you mean? I just gave you a potential one off the top of my head.
My
response was, but the defense though, so what you mean?
But that's my point though. You gave the potential rationale. We don't know if that's what that voter thought. It's because we don't know who that voter
is. I was just instigating you to rant, honestly.
No, I get you. But yeah, like I guess I always have quote unquote fun with some like the down ballot stuff. Again, like, that's a top three vote. So that's different. But like, there are a lot of players that got fourth and fifth place votes where I'm just like, surely you're not arguing they were. There were multiple players that one were not the best player on their team. Or two, were on teams that were not close to making the playoffs that got MVP votes. And I'm just like, how did we get here exactly? Like, I think I've had this rant on the pod before, so I'm not going to go too long on it. We got playoff talk to get to. But like, I've had this thing over years where it's just like some voters use their votes to give shout outs to people that they feel like haven't gotten enough love. And like, I understand the thought process behind it, but that quite literally is not what that's supposed to be for. Since quietly, like every award has like guidelines to how you're supposed to vote for these type things. And it's just like, if you feel like insert star here that had a really good season, but didn't make the playoffs deserves love. If you have a podcast, invite them on, write an article, make a YouTube video. That's not the time to say they were the fourth most valuable player in the league. Or the fifth most valuable. Like, that's not what that's for. Also, Steve, can I ask you a question while we're here?
What's up?
How did you feel about Liberty backcourt members getting MVP votes this year?
Well, fine.
Okay.
I'm not as passionate against people delivering their thoughts and opinions about basketball because they were asked to.
Well, you put it like that.
It doesn't fire me up that way. I'm sorry.
I just, you know.
What, look. Spirit of what? Coaches vote for stuff, you yell at them. Players vote for stuff, you yell at them. Media vote for stuff, you yell at them. It's just yelling all the time.
I would just like to understand. That's all. I never want to come off as like I'm the arbiter of basketball because, frankly, I'm just not even close to ever being that. I don't want to be that, ultimately.
I don't know, man. I just seen you on IG yesterday. Let me see.
What the fire? What does that mean?
Fire this up real quick.
Oh, brother. But like, I don't ever want to come off with that. Like, I obviously watch and do my research, or whatever, and I have my thoughts and how things should go. But like, I never come into this like it is my way or you are just wrong and you are stupid. Like, I don't have that. If there is an opinion that deviates very far from mine, considering how much I do watch and stuff, like I want to hear what the reasoning is. And like, even if I disagree, if I can see what the through line is, okay, this is just how this person thinks about this. Okay, this makes sense. I disagree for my own personal reasons, but okay, cool. And we can be cordial about it. What I don't generally like, especially, I guess, just on the W side, since unless the voters want to make their votes public, it's just not out there compared to other sports leagues and stuff. Is that I don't even get that. You just see Asia Wilson fourth place vote and we's got to sit in it. Not in the literal sense. Obviously, we can move on with our lives, whatever. But I'm just saying, like, we see that and then we don't even have. We have nothing to go off of. And like that just I don't love that. But that's all I have there. Shout out to Breonna Stewart once again for winning MVP in her second of her career. Which, as she was giving her MVP speech that her daughter Ruby just crashed, and it was the most hilarious and adorable thing. I was like, man, Stewie really had like two Achilles injuries. And she has come back and is still this on both ends of the floor. It is wild how talented she is, how impactful she is on both ends. And again, like career high in scoring for her, all the 40-point games, and then you just zoom out. The Liberty were seventh last year, and they were right behind the Aces this year. Defense took a jump. Offense took a jump. Stewie's at the heart of it. She was incredible. Again, you get the audio was there. Like, I thought Asian was the MVP. Steve has laid out eloquently multiple times at this point what Stewie's MVP case was, and she ultimately ended up winning it. What a race. Everyone have a lot of fun with this one.
Everyone had a case. It was a historic season from all three. It was tight for a reason. The split was going to be the split, but let's not forget, these three were amazing all year long, on top of amazing performances from other players that got votes. And they grew the game, and they elevated the game, and basketball's better off for it. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. At the very least, it should be. Like, let's not... it should be. Like, I'm excited to see, like, what the rest of this postseason looks like. Because on what? Like, at least one of the MVP candidates are going home soon in one series. One's guaranteed to go. And the other one is currently up 2-0, but like there still exists a chance of shifting to the road side. So we'll see. But let's get into some playoff talk off of that. Unless you had more MVP or general award thoughts.
No.
I think, as I said on the Monday episode, the next awards announcement should be Rookie of the Year / all rookie teams on Monday. So we'll have those. I would guess that Aaliyah Boston just wins Rookie of the Year handily. But I am excited to see what the all rookie team looks like. It's just top five rookies. They don't have two rookie teams like on the NBA side for those who are new to the W. So we'll see what the top five rookies are, regardless of position as well. So we'll see. Let's move to the playoffs as we have the game threes coming up on Friday. Again, recording early on a Thursday. We will start with the New York Liberty and the Connecticut Sun. The Liberty notched the series at one game apiece, an 84-77 victory over the Connecticut Sun. Benaja Laney bounced back with a 20-point performance. Sabrina Ionescu also bounced back with a 21-point performance. A double-double for Breonna Stewart, not the best scoring, 11 points, but 11 boards, 5 assists, 2 steals, and 5 blocks for her in this one. On the Connecticut side, playoff career high, 30 points for Tiffany Hayes, 19-7-4 for DeWanna Bonner, 10 points, 8 rebounds, 9 assists, and a steal for Alyssa Thomas. Steve, the Liberty were able to notch it up. What would you What would you say was the biggest reason they were able to pull that off?
They played defense and scored more points than the other team.
Ah, there we go.
Here's my thing. When I look at this game, it was very interesting. If you go back to the start of it, the Liberty looked way more like themselves. Offensively, making quicker decisions, looking to move the ball, playing with a lot more tempo and pace in the half court, just more decisive, action to action. Really worked to get paint touches offensively. They checked a lot of the boxes you were looking for. The defense was very active. They showed a lot more help. They were rotating more. They were working to deny. Switching was better. Sabrina was working to keep the ball in front. It looked fantastic. You look up, A, Tiffany Hayes did not care. B, the Sun are up 6 with 30 seconds left in that first quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well,
that's neat.
This is interesting. And I think part of that was because while the Liberty were playing defense better, they could not disrupt the Sun because the Sun are fine playing in the mud. They were able to stay patient. They were able to stay comfortable and run their sets and their actions. And then the zone came eventually. And I feel like that was the first moment where they were able to finally get the Sun into a mode of, okay, where are we looking to go offensively? What are we looking to do offensively? And that's where my head went initially. For the Liberty, I thought it was interesting. The Sun's defense was interesting to me. I felt like they were locked in on trapping Sabrina in game one. In game two, it didn't feel the same way. The coverages didn't feel the same. And Sabrina was able to find room and drive and get downhill. And if I'm the Sun, you cannot let her become a driver. You had Courtney Vandersloot with the moments where she would come off pick and roll. And Alyssa Thomas was kind of dropped back. but looking to work to get back to the pop, and Courtney would just turn the corner and finish. And it's like, well, I don't know if you could do that. And so the Liberty were able to stick around, gut it out. Everyone contributed. Everyone attacked, stayed aggressive. I think for the Sun, it's hard to have that game from Tiffany Hayes and lose. But it's like, they're going to be better against the zone eventually. So I don't think the Liberty can build. We're going to turn the series around just on that. I had mixed feelings after seeing it again. What were your thoughts? I know you dove back into it.
I was in an interesting place. Like, the zone obviously like popped for me. I think Synergy had it at 26 possessions of zone for the New York Liberty, which was easily a season high for them. And I think it was just the third, if I remember correctly, it's just the third time this season that they've logged 10 plus zone possessions in a game. And again, that 26 number was obviously the highest one that they had. And it almost immediately disrupted what Connecticut wanted to do. Because to your point, it was kind of a repeat of game one early on where, okay, we will use Alyssa Thomas as a hub. We'll have her higher up on the floor. Let's make sure we can engage Jonquel. Behind that, especially if they have the corners lifted, there's a whole lot of space for cuts or for a quick swing to the corner and then a drive and not having to deal with as much size at the rim with Jonquel kind of pulled away. And it felt like the zone was a way to not only just disrupt the general cadence of what Connecticut was getting to, but also we're keeping our size near the rim now. And so if you are finding pockets, it's going to be deeper in the wings for threes. DeJuan Bonner got a couple of those, didn't get him to go. Or if you engage the middle of the floor, here's Jonquel. If you try to attack an edge, here's Benijah or here's Breonna Stewart with Jonquel still lurking behind that. It was a way for the Liberty to kind of bring that, kind of centralize things defensively, I felt like. And so I like that for them. And I think zooming out, it's just kind of felt like the Suns doing everything they can, because you made the point about Alyssa Thomas working back to the Breonna Stewart pops. And she had a big one in the fourth quarter to put the Liberty up 10. And that felt like kind of a weight coming off the shoulder for her. But like, it's felt like Connecticut has done a whole lot to take away Breonna Stewart. And with the general size and how they're playing Alyssa Thomas, and something that you noted in the watch party live was how much more attention they sent to Alyssa Thomas in transition in game two compared to game one. It's the Liberty trying to take Alyssa Thomas off the table. It's the Sun trying to take Breonna Stewart off the table. The series has kind of, through two games, become, hey, what are these other players doing? In game one, up and down for Jonquel, Benijah didn't really have it. The guard play for the Connecticut Sun was strong. They found impact elsewhere. Rebecca Allen made big shots. Olivia Nelson-Adota, her defense popped. Sun win game one. Game two, again, not a great scoring effort for Breonna Stewart again. Here's Courtney Vandersloot. Here's Courtney Vandersloot with 19 and the timeliness of her buckets. Both those drives that you mentioned, also some timely corner threes. Here's Benijah Laney with 20 points, getting the post-ups, getting the drives, knocking down some crucial corner threes, grabbing some crucial offensive rebounds. There she is. Jonquel Jones, here's some early seals. Here's some timely offensive rebounds. Here's Sabrina Ionescu again as a driver. It's felt like the others more consistently showed up. And even others undersells them. Obviously, Sabrina's an all-star. Courtney Vandersloot, one of the best point guards of all time, etc. But it felt like the others outside of the MVP candidate showed up in a way for the Liberty that the Sun didn't consistently get. It was Tiffany Hayes, and then DeJuan Bonner hit some shots, but it wasn't, we didn't get the DeJuan Bonner avalanche, especially with like Breonna Stewart taking on more of that assignment in game two compared to game one. We didn't get, oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I thought that was a great adjustment, by the way. Keep going.
Oh, yeah. I would say because, well, Natisha Heideman went to the locker room early in that one, think she was dealing with some sort of sickness. But we didn't get the Natisha Heideman game that we got in game one. Ty Harris made some big shots, but it didn't feel the same because everyone else wasn't popping. Rebecca Allen started off relatively hot, not as hot as she did in that game one, where she scored 8 points in like the first 3 minutes. But she started off well, and then it turned into a foul trouble game for her. And so as those players didn't show up to the same degree, it just felt like the Liberty kind of swung it from there. They generally did a better job defensively. They were able to win the paint battle in a way that they didn't win in game one. And that's kind of how, I feel like that's kind of how it went for me, like thematically.
Rebecca Allen's very important for Connecticut in this series. I do think that the Liberty were a little more intentional to try and attack her on some of those switches that they had. and try and get her in the post, try and get her off Sabrina. But they're going to need her on both ends of the floor. My mind circles back to the zone from the Liberty in the interesting battle that's going to happen there. Because the Sun did have their issues with it. They also generated some pretty good looks once they got the Liberty's zone distorted and they messed the matchups a little bit and tilted it so the Liberty weren't able to match up the same way. The tricky part, I'm trying to balance which is going to win out. Because the strength of that Liberty zone is, one, slow you down, get you out of rhythm. Two, it's Jonquil, it's Stewie, it's Benangelani. They are all down there. So if you would like to go in the middle, Jonquil's there. If you think you're going to get a switch on Courtney Vandersloot or Sabrina Ionescu, the help is still there. Stewie's coming or Laney's coming in there, kick him out, and it's going to be fine. So can the Sun hit that button? But can the Liberty get their quote-unquote man-to-man defense to a point where they don't have to play zone all the time? Yeah. It can be a bonus as opposed to, this is the thing we have to do to stay in the game. But I also think the zone took away some of Nelson Adodo's impact offensively. I think it just opened things up for them, at least gave them more room for error. So again, defense is going to be so big for them.
Yeah, and I think it was smart not just to deploy it, but to deploy it against some of the lineups that Connecticut had out, namely having Olivia Nelson Adoda and Alyssa Thomas on the floor at the same time. It made it easier to play off of those players. Like, there's just, we've been talking about Connecticut shooting and how it would need to show up for them in a playoff setting pretty much all year long. And if you have Alyssa Thomas, who has kind of struggled with New York size throughout the season, and you don't get those same opponents on the, you know, in the intermediate area in the paint, and she's also just not going to stretch you out. Olivia Nelson Adoda also not going to stretch you out from deep. You're kind of restricted in the type of looks you can generate and feel good about. I'll put it that way. And so I do wonder, like, one, how Connecticut tries to counter, like, with their play calls. Are they going to flash someone middle? Are they going to try to go pick and roll at the top? Or what kind of looks do they try to get to? Like, there was a possession late in the first half, I want to say, that Connecticut tried to go to this elevator set for Ty Harris, and Sloot just blew it up. They tried to make an entry pass. It was like an elevator and then flowing into a high-low from there. And so as they tried to establish the high-low, Sloot just deflects the pass, pressures the ball, then jumps the pass. And so we don't even get to see what developed from that. So, like, there are certainly some wrinkles being drawn up by Stephanie White, so it's not like a lack of effort. But I want to see how much more she has in the bag if New York has to tap the zone button again in Game 3 or just moving forward. And to your point, can they get the man defense to a point to where they don't have to play as much as they did? Because I think ideally, even for Sandy Brondello, it'll been let's go zone, let's take, you know, get back into this, and then let's get back to what we do. And it went, it felt like zone, we're going to get back to our man and our switching. And then they went back to the zone once Connecticut got comfortable again. So we'll see what happens on that front. Big night for Sabrina Ionescu. Like, the drives were really impressive for her. I didn't love a couple of the calls on some of those, and I'm sure Rebecca Allen didn't either. But, like, just her general intention of getting downhill really popped in this game. Playoff career high 10 free throws for Sabrina in that game. Tied her season high as well with those 10 free throw attempts, going back to, I want to say, a June matchup against Atlanta, when she had, that was the 37-point game that she had, and all of the antics that flowed from that game that flowed into the other Liberty Dream game that didn't go well for the Dream, but neither here nor there. Big game for her. Back to Sloot very briefly, and I tweeted this out. Like, I felt like she was the player of the game. And I hope that doesn't come off as disrespectful to what Benaja did on both ends of the floor. Because she, obviously, if it wasn't Sloot, it was probably Benaja. But Sloot did so many things for them. Again, the drives hit. Timely three-point shot making. I really enjoyed her work as a screener on and off the floor. And I think quietly, she played a big role in disrupting some of Connecticut's defense in the half court, with her screening and then relocating from there. Defensively, she brought it very early on, getting the block slash tie up on Alyssa Thomas. You get a strip on Dawana Bonner that probably should have went the other way, but didn't. And then the pass deflection pick six that I just mentioned a little bit earlier when they were trying to work something against the zone. And she just blows it up from the top. Can't even get into the middle of the floor. Her defense, the screening, the playmaking, the drives, the timely shot making, like, Courtney Vandersloot just brought it. And I think she deserves her flowers for the game she had.
I'm with you there. Salute was key. So is Benaja. I got a question for you, though.
Okay.
Who gets loose first, Stewie or Alyssa Thomas?
Honestly, it kind of feels like Stewie by default, honestly. Because I'm, in light of how they're defending Alyssa in the half court, and then you throw in the zone, and then again, as you mentioned during our watch party on Tuesday, just the early pressure and occasional blitzing that she saw in transition, at least as a scorer, I'm struggling to see like how they're able to consistently unlock Alyssa Thomas. And I think with Stewie, you can move her around. You can press the post up button a little bit more. Now, there are degrees of how efficient those looks may be, et cetera. But like, I can envision just the shot making game from Stewie in a way that I don't really see for Alyssa right now, just scheme wise and the personnel that she's seen. Is that fair, or where would you go on that?
Keep going. Because I know you got to take. Keep going.
I don't know. Like, I circle back to the game one conversation you had about, I feel like Connecticut's going to be at their best if they can find a way to unlock Alyssa Thomas as a playmaker and a scorer. And I think just the general operate the offense above the break, pull Jonquel out, I think it's paying dividends for the offense as a whole because it opens up more driving lanes. It opens up just more room, but not behind Jonquel. But like, she still hasn't been able to successfully isolate her post against Jonquel. When she's gotten Stewie, she can move Stewie a little bit more, but that means there's more help behind that. And again, this isn't someone that you can't stash Alyssa Thomas in the corner and trust her to take those shots. She doesn't take threes. And if they are just crowding her more intentionally in transition, where some of the early, she gets those early pockets and get downhill, which very briefly, shout out to Sabrina Ionescu for just time got the Euro step on one of those. Want to give her the hat tip there. But like, if she can't get the transition stuff either, like, I don't know how you unlock both.
Which one's more important?
I think the playmaking is going to be more important, but, and this is something that I would like to talk through live if we can, like, it's kind of felt like the shift is going from the Sun guards have to show up for them to hit their ceiling to the Sun guards kind of have to carry it from a scoring perspective. And I don't feel super comfortable with that. Because again, talk about Alyssa, it's not like DeWanna has had a bunch of clean looks in this series through two games either. But with Alyssa having the balls, but she does, like, it would be nice, again, if they can find a way to unlock both. Even if I feel like, and I agree with you, like, the playmaking is probably more important.
I think Alyssa Thomas is going to play better. I also think the same for Brianna Stewart. I think they both will have games. Hold on, sorry. Here's the thing, right? 40 minutes a night. AT's playing 40 minutes a night. And this Liberty team has size at the rim to contest without fouling. So it's not like fouls are an automatic.
Mm-hmm.
There's help that comes. Moving Stewie onto Bonner now makes that action a switch. So unless it's going to have to be a blend from AT. She's going to have to mix in, get into the line, making a couple of those finishes, a couple of the short roll push shots. I think it's more timely baskets for her.
Mm-hmm.
Than anything else. That's where I'm at. So she stayed aggressive. I mean, she got 13 shots up in mm-hmm. that game too. I imagine being back at home, a couple days to sit with whatever you feel about the loss and the MVP. I expect improvement there. I just don't know if there's anything you can really tweak. You're not going to post her up. You have to tap the do better button. I think the thing is, what you don't want to have happen if you're the Sun, you get AT and DeWanna Bonner going, but you lose the aggression from your guards.
Yeah.
So while, yes, it's not ideal that Tiffany Hayes' amazing game two went from, wow, what a game, to, oh no, Connecticut needs this. But you don't want to flip it to where those two are playing well and no one else has joined the party now.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very fine line the Sun have to walk. And so that's where I'm like, I feel like DeJuana is the most unaffected to a degree because she can get to whatever she wants to get to whenever she wants to get to it. You need Hayes, Allen, and company to be aggressive. That's going to require them to be in action, which means AT has to pick her spots against size, against length, against zone, against help. And so is it a game where, hey, Jonquel picks up a quick two? Now those drives look a little different. Is that the margin for error? Or, hey, the Liberty aren't as locked in transition. Now AT gets a quick couple there. I think there's it's a slim margin.
Yeah. I got you. And like quietly, can you bring up the AT minutes? That's a good point. Like it kind of became the theme for both of these games where all four teams just kind of intentionally or not settled in on like six player rotations. And again, like you don't game plan for Natisha Hyman just having to go to the locker room in the first quarter for not feeling well. We'll put it that way. And we just did not see Dejanae Carrington in game two. Apparently the foot is still an issue for her. Like we knew the foot was still going to be an issue heading into it, but she did play it some in game one. If it's just worse and now she can't play, that also hinders your depth, which would I would imagine means more Olivia Nelson-Adota, which she's been really good defensively through two games. She's just been really good defensively in this postseason. But again, that is another non-space on the floor, which gives New York even more room to experiment defensively, whether that's zone or just sticking with their man, but also just having more help present elsewhere, depending on where Olivia Nelson is. I guess I keep coming back to what you said, like the margin for error. And it's something that you pointed out heading into the series, but it feels even more prevalent now. Like Connecticut just does not have a lot of it. And the Liberty, as you showcased in game two, where they go to a whole bunch of zone after not playing in game one, both schematically and in terms of just the do better button, they have more room to figure this out than Connecticut does. Whereas Connecticut just kind of feels like, to your point, like it's the do better button for Alyssa Thomas when she has these opportunistic pockets for scoring. When you get Sabrina matched up, you can't miss that one. It was a particularly, you know, quote unquote loud miss in the second half where she got Alyssa on the, where she got Sabrina on the switch. It was a bad miss. I'm like, well, that's one of your golden opportunities to actually get a bucket where you're not facing Jonquel or Breonna Stewart or Bonai Jelani, and they're not peeled in ready to help. You got to convert those. And it's just so tough for Connecticut. But I say all of that and I zoom out even more and it's Connecticut did their job. They stole one in New York and they're heading home. They're still in a good spot with 2 days of rest and then heading into this Friday night game. And if you do get the stewing from AT and DeJuana Bonner, like this could still be very interesting. Like it's a tie series. So we will see. I am keeping an eye on the bench though. Cause I thought about like New York zone. And now that I think about it, I don't know how much we even saw of like Thornton, Blaney, Stewie, Jonquel on the floor together like we did in game one. I kind of want to see that in game three, one, because I think that's a good lineup. But two, if you do that and then also go zone and you really just can't pick at anything, like I wonder what Connecticut does there. I'm excited for this one. Any closing thoughts before we move to Aces Wing?
Bonai Jelani was incredible. Stewie's going to be due. If Jonquel's going to get doubles, it gets very tricky.
There you go. To the second game of the night from Tuesday night, the Las Vegas Aces, a 91-84 victory. They now lead the series 2-0. They do have the ability to close things out on Friday as the series sifts to, I guess it's not technically Dallas, but for purposes of the name, as it shifts to Dallas to face the Wings. Asia with 30-11. In that game, too, becoming the first player in WNBA history to have 30 points in 3 straight playoff games, which her insane run continues. Chelsea Gray with 23 points, 5 boards, 8 assists, and a block, bouncing back from a quiet scoring game, still a good game in game one. Bounced back 9 quick points in the first quarter, really set the tone. Jackie Young with 13, Kelsey Plum with 18 for the Dallas Wings, 20-10 for Natasha Howard, bounced back from a relatively quiet offensive game, at least in game one. Arike with 24 points, Tierra McCowan with a 12-point, 10-rebound, double-double. Satu Sabally, 13 points, 6 boards, 4 assists, a steal, and 3 blocks in this one. I feel like I found myself in a similar place that you did after game one, where I was like, I kind of like what Dallas went to and some of the shifts that they made. But also, as it pertains to the Las Vegas Aces, like, you get a starting lineup change for Dallas. You get Odyssey Sims in for Crystal Dangerfield. You get a little bit more size. They go more quote unquote natural with the matchups, with Odyssey Sims just taking on Chelsea Gray. You got Arike on Kelsey. You got Satu on Jackie Young. That's more length on Jackie. And you kind of saw that with some of the early pick and rolls. In game one, those were just immediate pull up threes. Against Satu, Jackie kind of had to think about it a little bit more. And Jackie did go, I think, 1 of 8 from three in that game. Natasha Howard now going back to Asia Wilson after Tierra McCowan got the primary assignment in game one. More mobility on Asia, can get a little bit more activity in their pick and rolls in particular. Keep Tierra McCowan close to the basket. I got it. Early in the first quarter, at the very least, Dallas felt more comfortable getting to their high lows. They were very intentional about keeping that weak side corner not just empty, very much empty. Like, Arike just very high up on the wing and trying to set up those high lows. You got a couple of early post touches there. But then you get Asia just setting a tone. Chelsea Gray setting a tone. Timely shot making. Ace is starting the game out in zone. Like, I guess that was the other thing with Dallas. Not only feeling more comfortable setting up those high lows, the Ace is starting this game in zone, much like they did their last regular season matchup where they jumped up to that 16-0 lead. They start in zone, and Dallas just very comfortably like, okay, we can just do this. We'll move here. We'll cut here. Let's get a look. And I asked Coach Trammell about that after the game. Like, was it just execution? Was this something that you kind of game planned for? Or, like, what did you like about the zone? She was like, we've seen everything that they do. Like, we know what they want to do in the various zone looks that they want to get to. We identified it very quickly, and we got to what we wanted to get to instead of, like, stopping and sputtering and stuff. And so, like, that was impressive. Dallas felt prepared for this one, and it ultimately didn't matter. Like, I do feel like they kind of lost the plot a little bit on the interior in the second half of this game. And even within that, Aces make a run. They go up 13. The Wings are right there. Chip it to 5. You get a tie game. It goes back up to 5. And the Wings are just right there. And they took, I think, 22 more shots than the Aces did. Crushed it on the offensive glass. Missed some bunnies. Like, you can't game plan for make more layups off of offensive rebounds. That feels like something that can, or at the very least they hope, course corrects as the series shifts. I don't know. Like, I like a lot of what Dallas did, and Vegas made enough plays to overcome it either way. What were some of your takeaways from this game too?
I mean, just margin for error for Dallas. I don't think they played their best, but to your point, they are always there. They are always scrapping. They're fighting on both ends of the floor. It's just trying to make things easier offensively. They find pockets, they find things, but I don't know if there's one thing we could point to say, this is there all the time. Now, part of that is a credit to the Aces defense for staying locked in. Every time you kind of see something develop, hey, you want to go horns, high, low, we're fighting that. Pick and roll, we're fighting that. Handoffs, we're fighting that. But when you look at it, I think number one, you got to find an easier shot diet for Satu. Ironically, I felt like in game one, there was a lot of things they missed early in that one as far as switching and her posting up. And then in game two, it felt like they wanted to get her more involved, but it was more, hey, here's the ball.
Yeah.
And so you end up with 13 points, 17 shots. Arike, 24 points, 22 shots. Natasha, 20 points, 18 shots. And so if you can find a way to make it a little bit easier and generate some of those shots, because they found pockets in each rally or in each quarter to get right back in it. Third quarter, they were cooking in pick and roll. Mm-hmm. They got what they wanted to. But now it's just, can we keep that going? How much transition can we get to? And then you have to combine the defense as well. It's hard. It's hard. When you look at the space that Asia sees when she catches the ball, and it's not even like Dallas is playing poor defense. It's just a tough decision. Your hope is finish over the size. We can stay at home. The problem is Asia's cooking. So do you tap that button? Do you open that door? And so it just kind of feels like when the offense is in one place, the defense is another. When the defense is in one place, the offense starts to perk up. And so they have the formula. It's just, can they find that consistency and put together 40 minutes against this team? But that's the tough part about facing the Aces. Because you go from game one, where Asia had that game, and game two, where Chelsea Gray from the jump says, hey, I'm here too. And then finishes in the fourth with, hey, just so y'all remember, I'm here too. Light this pick and roll, space, get to my spot, bop. So they're just going to have to come out swinging. But I anticipate in front of that home crowd, they're going to get ready and be willing and able to get in the mud.
They're going to have to. And like, just to go back to something you said a little bit earlier, I think the usage of the wing stars is kind of what popped for me in this game too. You mentioned the Satu point. I also go to Arike, and this is something that I asked her about post game, where the Aces have pretty consistently put two on the ball against her. And this is something that you brought up throughout the regular season. Like, I wish the Wings could get more out of two on the ball versus Arike, because in theory, that should be an advantage for you to take advantage of, etc. And so I asked her, like, how are there ways that you feel like you can get yourself open in more clean pockets? Because in ball screens, you're getting two. And even with some of the off-ball stuff, you'll get a catch. And, like, they love to flow out of horns, or she'll come off, like, the Iverson's cut, get the ball on the wing, and then they flow into an empty side pick and roll from there. She catches the balls and turns. Someone, a big's already creeping up to the level. And it's like, well, I don't really have a pocket. Like, there was one of those off-screen actions, I want to say, in the second half, where she just dotted Asia's eye with a three. But, like, that's a really tough shot. And so she did mention, like, she could probably get more use as a screener since they're putting two on the ball against her so much, and see if she could open up some things that way. They did sprinkle some of those possessions in this game, too. So I'm curious to see if they tap that button more in game three, whether it's, you know, if she's at the elbow and some of their horns looks and flowing from there, or just some random, I'll just run over and set a screen and see if I can get something early. But it hasn't felt like they've been able to get her comfortable looks either. And that brought me back to that game one, like, mid-game interview, like, Ross Golden Wooden made the comment about the huddle, where it's like, hey, Arike's taking some of these shots, we kind of need to relax. I'm also just kind of like, hey, man, one, you need her offense. Two, the Aces have taken so much of the pet stuff for Arike off the table with their pressure. She's probably also feeling like, I have to impact this some kind of way, and I have to get mine, and I am someone that can make tough shots. And so I wonder, like, what the balance is going to be there. Because, again, like, I think Jackie Young has just done a really good job through two games in this series. In addition to, oh, we will bring our big higher up on the floor. You're not getting to turn the corner against us. Not consistently, anyway. And so is there a way that they can, one, get Arike open? Two, if they do go to the Arike as a screener button, can you use Arike and Satu together to get both of them cleaner looks? Do we get some do we get Arike setting some cross screens for Satu to set up a post up? Can they even get to those looks if they are in some of their bigger lineups? Which, again, it's all a whole lot of moving pieces. Because I feel like when Tierra McCowan or Kalani Brown aren't involved, they're either on the opposite block or they're in that short corner area. And then whoever's guarding them is just firmly in the paint. And so, like, trying to generate spacing can get wonky against an Aces team that has gotten more and more aggressive with helping off some of their non-shooters. We saw in game one, like, that Crystal Dangerfield hit shots, but there weren't Aces very close to her when she hit those shots. And that was intentional. I feel like as the series has gone on, the Aces are creeping further and further off of Natasha Howard when she's spaced. And that was something that I was kind of looking at with Atlanta in that first round series. And you saw that in that first quarter where they exploded. It was like, oh, no, we're just helping on this post entry. We don't care about where Natasha is spaced. The Aces seem to be taking the page off of that book, out of that book as well. So it's not going to be easy, but they're going to have to find a way to get Arike and Satu just cleaner looks. And I think they have the talent to get it going. But I want to see how they go about doing that.
Do you have any Aces concerns? That's been my question.
Aces concerns, like, they got beat up on the glass more in game two than they did in game one. And so, like, that's always going to be how well can the guards help on the glass. This was the rare early foul trouble game for Asia as well. And she was kept in the game and she was able to hold serve. But, like, that's something that you have to keep an eye on. If Satu is going to be on Jackie more consistently in game three or just moving forward, like, how can they get her open looks? Like, one, the pull-ups aren't going to be as prevalent. I don't think the drive is going to be as prevalent because of Satu's length and her improvement on the defensive end. You could you can kind of get Satu on some cuts because the off-ball stuff isn't always there for her. But even then, like, that isn't something you can really bank in, I don't think. So I would keep my eye on that. And then just a general bench note, because I think it was, what, 4 points for Alicia Clark. Another low bench scoring game. Pretty much, again, a six-player rotation for the Aces in this one. We haven't seen... We saw Kirsten Miller game
one. Is that Kayla George erasure?
Well, it's not. I was saying, someone that logged, like, you know, 15-plus minutes, like, that wasn't Kayla George.
So you only play 15 minutes and get some love. I see what's going on, bud.
Oh Lord.
You said it. Don't get mad at me.
Do you have Aces concern?
No. I think the big thing is they got to the line 25 times. And so the drives again are continuing to be important. And they're still moving the ball. They're still playing together. Now, what's interesting is the assist numbers are not matching.
Mm-hmm.
Game one, 37 made field goals, 18 assists. Game two, 30 made field goals, 17 assists. Does that get to them at some point? Now, it's not apples to apples because I have loved the way that they have attacked Dallas's rotating defense and they've looked to create for each other. But on the road, is that a scenario where that bites them, where they're not able to generate the same type of looks? Maybe they're not knocking down the same shots. They don't get the same whistle. Do they find themselves in the mud? Because while we have concerns about the Wings offense, they've scored 80 plus in both these games.
Mm-hmm.
And the Aces shooting went from 53% in game one to 46 in game two. Can the Wings catch them and get this in a spot where, hey, we're a little bit closer to the mud?
I think that's a fair point. And that's an interesting point. I was looking it up briefly because the Aces finished eighth in assist rate this past year, which is probably lower than people would anticipate with a team that moves the ball as well as they do. But they were eighth. Around 64% of their shots were assisted on. In this series so far, 52.2. It's much lower than what it has been. And so I think it is worth keeping an eye on. I think they've been so intentional about trying to find spacing and find pockets for like Asian to attack in particular, to where those assist opportunities aren't there, but they're still generating fruitful stuff and get to the line. But yeah, like you would like to see that perk up some. You would like to see them get some easier or just more transition opportunities in general. I think I noted it before the series, like quietly, Dallas had more transition points in the regular season series than the Aces did. And so like maybe that would be an avenue where you see some of the easiest assist opportunities for the Aces. So we'll see on that front. I guess very briefly, like I mentioned the first quarter, that wasn't the only time the Aces went zone in that game. How did you feel about the Aces zone and how Dallas dealt with it?
I felt fine. I think the bigger thing is the Aces don't have to lean on it. That's the biggest one to me. If we can throw it in there and mix it in and we can potentially, if you get some momentum or we try and throw you off, it's not the base. I think that's the biggest part.
Got you. Okay. I don't have any closing thoughts. I also do not have free throws. Do you have free throws?
What a shocker, pal. Wow. What a shocker.
Let the record show, I just had free throws on the last episode. Continue.
Do you want to let the record show?
You have to more consistently than I do.
Would you like to go let the record show here? Is that really the verse you would like to go with?
Look, I'm not arguing that you had the last one. I'm just saying, I'm not arguing that you have them more consistently than I do. That is verifiable fact. I will take the L on that. I'm just saying, to shocker, I just did it this week. That's the only thing I'm saying. I just had them 2 days ago. That's all.
All right. Who's happier? Adrian Griffin or Tyler Hero?
Probably Adrian Griffin.
What time did the Bucks send the "Did you sign it yet?" text to Giannis?
Hold on. Let me see when the trade was announced. a minute after that, I think it's going to be the answer.
In more misery, Heat fans or the person who voted Asia Wilson fourth in the MVP race and has not told anyone in their lives?
Heat fans in four, because that voter just does not, you could just live in it. Anyway, it's the Heat fans for me.
What were you about to say?
We just never gonna know who made that vote. So what they upset for? They getting packed up. We ain't even gotta know they getting packed up.
Jazz Plus and Chill.
Hey, one, that's wild. That's a wild shot. Two, hey man, a team based TV package, and you also get two home games out of that, and then other stuff on top of that. That ain't bad. That ain't bad.
That's all I had. Okay. We had a lot of hoops to talk about, buddy.
Yeah, we'll run it back on the next episode, which again, we'll get the Rookie of the Year announcement and the All Rookie Team announcement. We'll have more playoff takes for you. Maybe we get a Drew trade this weekend, so we'll see. We'll have that. But we are shifting to some of our season/division previews on the NBA side. So excited about that one. Turning the NBA brain on in full while also having the W brain on. So again, still playoff coverage coming, but it's time to start previewing this 2023-24 NBA season. I'm excited for it. With that being said, thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, I guess Google with an asterisk. I don't know how much longer it's going to be on Google. We'll see. Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter. We're having fun discussions in there. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. We are watching a little bit of everything, but you know, main priority right now is the WNBA playoffs. We will be locked in for those games on Friday night. The Liberty and the Sun up first. We get the Aces of the Wings shortly after. Come watch some playoff hoops with us. Live analysis. We're having fun basketball discussions in there. The room in general is just a fun, inclusive place. Plenty of food takes and stuff mixed in there as well. So you'll get plenty of laughter and also some analysis. It's also Friday. Maybe we can sneak in some SmackDown if the timeout breaks match up. We'll see what happens. We're going to have some fun. The link to the room should be hyperlinked in your podcast description. Click on that link into your information. It is free. No shenanigans. If it isn't hyperlinked, just copy and paste that link into your browser. Once again, it is free. Absolutely no shenanigans. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Taylor Swift's going to be at the Jets game. Woo!